Welcome to the Connecticut Freedom Trail. This tour takes you to northwestern Connecticut, where we explore sites in Farmington, Torrington, Norfolk, North Canaan, Danbury, Waterbury, and Plainville. Specific directions to each Freedom Trail site and suggestions on how to get the most out of this auto tour tape series are in the companion booklet. At the end of each site description on this tape, you will hear this tone.
For 350 years, in the big cities and small towns of Connecticut, there has been a little-known struggle for freedom and equality. From the founding of the Connecticut colony, people of African descent faced slavery and racial discrimination. But from the earliest days, some Connecticut residents, both people of color and white people, have fought against racial prejudice and oppression. The Connecticut Freedom Trail commemorates their struggle. These are the stories of the struggle to free the African captives of the ship the Amistad, the Underground Railroad, the birthplace of abolitionist firebrand John Brown, the story of James Mars and his family, fugitive slaves hidden by the people of a neighboring town, a pioneering African-American volunteer in the Civil War, the world-renowned singer Marian Anderson, and an African-American community center whose members' campaigns overcame discrimination against the hiring of black women. Farmington, like many Connecticut towns, once had African-American slaves. Yet as early as 1696, it also had a free black, Frank Freeman, who was indeed a free man, a landowner, the husband of a white woman, and a holder of public office in the town. Slavery was gradually abolished in Connecticut, and by 1820, there were no more slaves in Farmington. But people of color were far from equal. For example, a black man could be thrown off the stagecoach from Hartford to New Haven if a white passenger demanded it. John Hooker, a lawyer and an ardent opponent of slavery, grew up in Farmington in the 1820s.
The black man seemed to have no rights as a man. He was often kindly regarded by humane people, but such a thing as his having the rights of a man was hardly thought of. In church, he sat in the Negro's pew, a pew close by the door in the lower part of the house or in the gallery.
In 1836, a men's anti-slavery society was organized in Farmington with 70 members, and a women's anti-slavery society was established with 40 members.
When the anti-slavery movement came along, it met not only with ridicule, but with persecution.
Hooker recounted that when an abolitionist minister spoke at the Farmington Union Hall,
a stone was thrown with great violence through the window back of the desk at which he was speaking, which passed close by his head and went across the hall to the wall on the other side. It might have killed one whom it chanced to hit.
But Farmington attitudes were transformed by the arrival of unexpected visitors from afar, the African captives from the ship the Amistad. On August 26, 1839, a Connecticut newspaper wrote,
"Much excitement has been created in New York for the past week from the report of several boats having seen a schooner full of Negroes and in such condition as to lead to the suspicion that she was a pirate."
The long black schooner was the Amistad. A United States Navy ship sighted her near Long Island and captured her. It took prisoner the Africans who were in control of the Amistad, released two white Spaniards they were holding, and towed the ship to New London, Connecticut. The next day, Federal District Judge Andrew T. Judson heard the Spaniards give their version of the Amistad story.
"I bought 49 slaves in Havana, Cuba, and shipped them on board the schooner Amistad."
Ruiz was accompanied by another Spaniard, Pedro Montes, and four children he had bought as slaves. The Amistad sailed for the Spaniards' plantations in another part of Cuba. But after 3 days, a rebellion broke out. led by Sing Bay Pie, whom the Spaniards called by the name Joseph Cinque. The Africans killed most of the Spanish crew. They ordered Montes and Ruiz to head the Amistad towards the rising sun back to Africa. But at night, the Spaniards secretly turned the ship around and headed up the coast of North America, eventually making their way to Long Island Sound. The two Spaniards asked the court to hand over the Amistad to Spanish officials. They also demanded the cargo, and they included as part of the cargo the black men and children they claimed to own as slaves. Judge Judson decided that the African men should be charged with mutiny and murder, and the children held as witnesses. They were all taken to the New Haven jail to await trial. A New London abolitionist named Dwight Janes immediately contacted abolitionists elsewhere about the Amistad. They saw it as a heaven-sent opportunity to call public attention to the evils of slavery. They quickly formed the Amistad Committee and requested contributions to hire lawyers for the captives.
38 fellow men from Africa, kidnapped from their native land, transported across the seas, and subjected to atrocious cruelties.
Josiah Willard Gibbs, a professor of languages at Yale University, visited the Africans. After learning to count from 1 to 10 in their language, Professor Gibbs went to New York and walked up and down the docks, counting out loud, until he found James Covey, an African seaman who could understand his counting. With Covey to interpret, the captives were finally able to tell their story. Most were Mende, a people who live in what is now Sierra Leone. They had been captured in Africa by Africans who sold them to European slave traders. They were brought to the Spanish colony of Cuba, where 53 of them were sold as slaves to Ruiz and Montes. They were loaded on the Amistad. Cinque, their acknowledged leader, was told that a terrible fate lay ahead.
The cook told us they carry us to some place and kill and eat us.
That night, Cinque used a nail to break his padlock, then unchained his companions. They found sugarcane knives and stormed the deck.
Cinque killed Cook because Cook said he was going to kill them and eat them. He killed the captain after he killed an African.
After months of delay, the Amistad case finally came to trial in New Haven. Judge Judson held that the Africans were neither slaves nor Spanish subjects. They were therefore free by the law of Spain itself.
Cinque and Grabeau shall not sigh for Africa in vain. Bloody as may be their hands, they shall yet embrace their kindred.
But the United States government appealed the decision to the Supreme Court. The abolitionists persuaded a former president of the United States, John Quincy Adams, to help argue their case before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that the Africans were entitled to their liberty like any other free-born human beings and should be free to go wherever they wished. The court said they had exercised an ultimate right.
The ultimate right of all human beings in extreme cases to resist oppression and to apply force against ruinous injustice.
Free at last, the 38 Mende, 35 men and boys, and 3 girls were brought to Farmington by abolitionist supporters. They stayed here for 8 months from March to November 1841. Charles Ledyard Norton was a small child in Farmington at that time.
When it was decided to quarter them in Farmington, pending arrangements for their return to Africa, there was consternation among the timid souls in the quiet village. Stories of cannibalism were plentifully circulated, and there were formal protests against forcing such a burden upon the community.
Nonetheless, the supporters of the Mende prevailed.
Barracks were erected, and here the former captives made their home. Sinke was a born ruler, and ably seconded by his lieutenant, Grabo, he maintained a very creditable degree of discipline among his followers. They were, for the most part, free to roam about, except for regular school hours, and townsfolk soon ceased to fear them. Anxious mamas at first trembled and kept their children behind bolted doors, but before long, it was no uncommon sight to see the big, grown-up blacks playing with little white children in village dooryards.
Farmington played a crucial role in the Amistad drama. Farmington sites associated with the Amistad are included on the Freedom Trail.
The first site on the northwestern section of the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Barney House in Farmington.
The house where Charles Ledyard Norton grew up is the first Farmington stop on the Freedom Trail. Built by his father, John Treadwell Norton, president of the New York Central Railroad, one of the most famous abolitionists of his day and a major supporter of the Amistad Africans, Charles Ledyard Norton recalled,
"The African visitors were often welcomed by my father at his home. A broad flight of steps led down from the southern piazza, and I distinctly remember seeing the athletic Sinke turn a somersault from these steps and then go down the sloping lawn in a succession of handsprings, heels overhead, to the wonderment and admiration of my big brothers and myself."
Those front steps and lawn can still be seen at what is known today as Barney House. Looking across the front lawn, you will see the best view of the first of five underground railroad sites in Farmington, the Elijah Lewis House.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Elijah Lewis House in Farmington.
Many Farmington abolitionists took part in what came to be known as the Underground Railroad, a loosely knit network of hideouts and secret escape routes throughout the country that helped thousands of fugitive slaves escape to freedom. Farmington abolitionism grew after the visit of the Amistad captives to the point that the town came to be known as the Grand Central Station of the Underground Railroad. Fugitive slaves entering the state from Wilton, New Haven, or Hartford often passed through Farmington on their way to Westfield or Springfield, Massachusetts, and points north. In 1840, abolitionist John Treadwell Norton published an account of the Underground Railroad at work. He was attending a meeting at the office of the Connecticut Anti-Slavery Society in Hartford.
"A respectable gentleman came to the door, evidently in haste and somewhat agitated. The gentleman was under great anxiety on account of a young colored man who had been in his employ about 3 months and who had just come to him in the deepest distress, confessing that he was a runaway slave, and stating that he had that moment seen his master and a noted slave dealer pass by, evidently in search of him and suspecting his residence. The gentleman and his family had become much interested in the young man and were distressed at the thought of his being carried back into slavery. No time was to be lost, as Charles, the name of the young man, was confident he had been seen by his master. Directions were given that he should go immediately and as privately as possible to a house designated in the outskirts of the city, and a gentleman present undertook to take him to F without delay."
Historians are confident that the town Norton designated simply with the letter F was Farmington.
"I saw Charles for a few moments. When I knew that he was a slave, that one, who I could not but feel was endowed by his maker with qualities, to say the least, equal to any that I myself possessed, that such an one should, in this land of boasted freedom, and in Connecticut too, be claimed as a slave, and be compelled to flee before his fellow man, though guilty of no crime, this greatly increased my interest, and I felt that there was a law, infinitely superior to any human laws, that called upon me to assist him in this his extremity.
Charles had one day's rest in F when one of the abolitionists, identified by Norton only as Mr. B, arrived.
Mr. B came in great haste and advised that he be immediately removed to some other place, as large rewards were offered for his apprehension. I shall not soon forget Charles's quivering lip, nor his expression of eye when told that he could not remain here. Had the baying of bloodhounds fallen upon his ear, his spirit could not have sunk more within him. This feeling, however, was but for a moment. A rigidity of muscle and a determined expression soon followed, and no one could for an instant suppose that it was an idle threat when he said,
"I will die rather than go back to slavery."
Charles's trunk had been sent to my care, and at about 10 o'clock, one of our most respectable citizens, with a worthy colored man, a resident of the town, called for the trunk with Charles. The tones of his voice and the pressure of his hand, as I bade him goodbye, touched my heart, and it was also affecting to see the disinterested benevolence of those who had undertaken on a night of almost pitchy darkness to guide this poor stranger to a place of safety. They found a willing friend in a secluded part of the town, who secreted him for a few days, when another devoted friend of the slave rode 40 miles between 9 o'clock in the evening and daylight the next morning, placing the poor fellow entirely out of danger. Charles was obliged to leave his country for Canada, where he arrived in safety. Queen Victoria has thereby gained a valuable subject, and we have lost one, besides adding to the long list of wrong and oppression, which already disgraces us in the eyes of the civilized world, and which cries to heaven for vengeance.
The Underground Railroad was clandestine. Runaway slaves could be seized and returned south, and helping them was a crime. So concrete evidence of stations and their activities is often spotty. The Freedom Trail includes 5 Farmington sites that were probably part of the Underground Railroad. The Elijah Lewis House was moved to its present site from 738 Farmington Avenue. Elijah Lewis was an active agent for the Underground Railroad. At the base of the house's huge chimney stack in the basement is a removable stone, which is thought to have provided a hiding place for fugitive slaves.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Farmington Historical Society in Farmington.
Established in 1954, the Farmington Historical Society is the primary source of information about the Amistad story in the area.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Smith Coles House in Farmington.
The Smith Coles House is one of the better documented Underground Railroad sites. Owner Horace Coles was an active abolitionist. His son, who later inherited the house, was the editor of an abolitionist paper in Hartford. One of the 3 girls from the Amistad incident, Cagney, stayed at this house for most of the time the freed captives lived in Farmington.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is First Church of Christ Congregational in Farmington.
Leaders of both abolitionist and anti-abolitionist movements were members of the Farmington Congregational Church. many members supported the Amistad Africans, providing them with clothes, housing, education, and Christian teaching while they lived in Farmington, and helping raise money for them to return to Africa. The church, a national historic landmark, looks today very much as it did when the Amistad Africans were there. The Africans sat in the left-hand balcony as you face the pulpit.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Union Hall in Farmington.
The Union Hall, originally next door to the Congregational Church where Porter Memorial now stands, is now located behind the church. Its upper floor was rented to both abolitionist and anti-abolitionist groups for meetings. When the Amistad Africans arrived in March with inadequate clothing, women of the Congregational Church met here to sew clothing for them. It is now the Art Guild.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Samuel Deming House in Farmington.
Samuel Deming was one of the abolitionists who brought the Amistad Africans to Farmington. A descendant of one of the founders of Farmington, Deming was a merchant and state legislator. His house was also a station on the Underground Railroad. Since 1940, the house has been the home of the head of Miss Porter's school.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Samuel Deming Store in Farmington.
This building was Samuel Deming's store, originally located next to his home. For their first 6 weeks in Farmington, the African men and boys from the Amistad lived and studied on the second floor. After they moved into their dormitory, it served as their schoolroom, where they attended classes for 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. The building is still operated as a store.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Reverend Noah Porter House in Farmington.
Noah Porter was the minister of the Farmington Congregational Church. His house served as home for Margrew, one of the three African girls in the Amistad group. Margrew returned to Africa with the others, but ultimately returned to America, attended Oberlin College in Ohio, and became a teacher in Sierra Leone.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Austin F. Williams House and Carriage House in Farmington.
Austin F. Williams was one of the abolitionists who brought the Amistad Africans to Farmington. Realizing that the quarters above Samuel Deming's store were inadequate, he made land available, where the townspeople built a barn-like structure to house the men and boys, while the three girls were taken into private homes. While somewhat remodeled later to serve as a carriage house, the building still shows, virtually unchanged, the second-floor dormitory and Sinque's private room, as well as the back-to-back privies with a total of 7 holes. An addition, known as the Mirror House, became a station on the Underground Railroad, complete with a trap door to a basement hiding place. After the Civil War, Austin Williams used the Mirror House as an employment office for freed blacks.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Timothy Wadsworth House in Farmington.
Tradition links this house to the Underground Railroad. A concealed room in the cellar and a slot just below the roof peak could have served as hiding places for fugitives.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is Foon's Grave in Farmington.
One of the Amistad Africans, Foon, drowned while swimming in Pitcairn Basin and is buried in Riverside Cemetery. At the back of the cemetery is the Farmington River and the Farmington Canal, which is now a paved road, and an open meadow where the Africans planted and raised their own food. Also buried in Riverside Cemetery are Samuel Deming, Austin Williams, John Treadwell Norton, and his son, Charles.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Canal House and Pitcairn Basin in Farmington.
This was the location where the Amistad's Foon drowned. The small, distinctive building on the far right was the Canal House. What is now the paved parking lot in front of the Canal House was the Canal Basin, where canal boats were turned and docked overnight. It was also here that the Africans embarked to other towns to give exhibitions and raise money for their return to Africa. Thousands throughout the country contributed to help the Mende return to Africa. They raised enough money to hire a ship for the 35 surviving Africans and 5 missionaries. Charles Ledyard Norton's older brother, John Pitkin Norton, who had been a tutor for the Mende, recorded in his diary their departure from Farmington.
Grand farewell to the Mendes at church. A great crowd, house, and gallery filled. Dr. Haas preached the sermon, and there were exercises from the Mende, as well as several songs. Sinque delivered a speech in Mende. Mr. Williams explained the need for funds, and in a few minutes, $1,150 was subscribed.
As the former captives reached the coast of Sierra Leone, Sinque wrote to a leader of the Amistad Committee.
I thank all American people for they send Mende people home. I shall never forget American people. Your friend, Sinque.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Uriel Tuttle House in Torrington.
The Torringford area on the outskirts of Torrington was also a center of abolitionist activity, with 40 members of its anti-slavery society by 1837. But there were anti-abolitionists too. In 1837, a mob, blowing horns, yelling, and beating on tin pans and kettles, surrounded an abolitionist meeting and broke it up. One route of the Underground Railroad led from Farmington to Torringford. The Freedom Trail lists 2 Underground Railroad sites in the Torringford district of Torrington.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Isaiah Tuttle House in Torrington.
Uriel Tuttle and his father Isaiah Tuttle were leaders of the abolitionist group in Torringford and provided a way station on the Underground Railroad. Both Uriel Tuttle, who died in 1849, and Isaiah Tuttle, who died in 1831, are buried in Tarringford Cemetery on Tarringford Road behind the church.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is John Brown's birthplace in Torrington.
John Brown was born in Torrington in 1800 in a simple wooden house which survived until it burned in 1918. He moved away at 5, but returned to Connecticut at 16 to study at the Morris Academy not far from Torrington. Brown, following in the footsteps of his father, became an ardent abolitionist. With volunteers, funding, and guns from Connecticut and other northern states, he played a leading role in the 1856 guerrilla war between pro- and anti-slavery forces in the Kansas Territory. In 1859, John Brown developed a plan to initiate guerrilla war, free slaves, and perhaps provoke a slave insurrection in the South. He received funding from Northern abolitionists and pikes made by the Collins Company in Canton, Connecticut. With 18 black and white supporters, he attacked the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Brown's force seized the arsenal, but after 2 days of battle, they were taken prisoner by United States Marines. John Brown was convicted of treason and hanged. The Harper's Ferry attack greatly alarmed slaveholders in the South, who soon after began discussing secession from the United States. When the Civil War broke out, Union soldiers marched through the country singing. The house foundation, a well hole, and a stone marker can be seen at John Brown's birthplace. Brown remains a controversial figure to this day, even in the town of his birth. John Brooks, a Torrington banker and a member of the John Brown Association, which maintains the Brown homestead, said in 1995,
"There's nothing to admire in John Brown. I wouldn't honor him. That guy got us into the Civil War. John Brown was born here, but that isn't anything we should be proud of. That scoundrel took the law into his own hands."
But Ernest Cedar, Torrington's municipal historian, gave a different view.
"I think he was one of the greatest men in American history. He was instrumental in waking up the North about its apathy to slavery."
Before his death sentence was pronounced, John Brown addressed the court regarding what he referred to as his interference with slavery.
"Had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right. Every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than punishment. I am yet too young to understand that God is any respecter of persons. I believe that to have interfered as I have done in behalf of his despised poor, I did no wrong, but right."
Two of John Brown's sons were killed at Harper's Ferry, and Brown told the court,
"Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children, and with the blood of millions in this slave country, whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I say, let it be done."
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is James Marr's grave in Norfolk.
In 1784, Connecticut passed a law providing for the gradual emancipation of slaves, so gradual that slavery was not totally abolished until more than 60 years later. The law provided that the children of slaves would themselves be slaves, but must be freed when they reached the age of 25. James Marr was born a slave in Connecticut in 1790. He and his family were owned by the Congregational minister of Canaan.
The Reverend Mr. Thompson bought my father, and he was married to my mother by him. Mr. Thompson ministered to the people of Canaan in holy things. His slaves worked his farm. The treatment of slaves was different at the North from the South. At the North, they were admitted to be a species of the human family. I was told when a slave boy that some of the people said that slaves had no souls and that they would never go to heaven. Let them do ever so well.
When James was 8, Reverend Thompson threatened to take the family to the South. James's father, Jupiter Mars, instead put his family in a wagon in the middle of the night and fled to the nearby town of Norfolk, whose people were at odds with the people of Canaan. Their first stop was the Pettibone Tavern, a stagecoach stop on the Hartford-Albany Turnpike built by Giles Pettibone in 1794, which can be seen in Norfolk today.
We stopped at a tavern kept by Mr. G. Pettibone, and in him we found a friend. It was soon known in the morning that we were in Norfolk. The first inquiry was, where will they be safe? There was a man that had a house that was not occupied. After breakfast, we went to the house. We all went to work and got it cleaned.
But the family heard that Reverend Thompson had found out where they were.
A man that lived near to us said he would take the boys where they would be safe. He went with us over a mountain, over rocks and logs. It was very rough and steep, and the night was so dark that we could only see when it lightened. At last, we got through the woods on the top of what is called Burr Mountain.
Over the course of several months, at least 10 different Norfolk families hid James and his family. Several structures associated with people who aided the Mars family in Norfolk can still be seen. In his memoir, James Mars wrote of the friendly kindness extended to him by Mrs. Thomas Curtis and her boys. Their large white house, built in 1786, still stands. The Mars family was also helped by Ariel Lawrence, whose tavern is now a residence. At one point, Reverend Thompson and his supporters concluded that the Mars family was being hidden there.
They knew that Mr. Lawrence loved money. They thought they would tempt him with that. So they came to his house and made trial. He finally told them on certain conditions they might go into every room but one. They went into all the rooms but one. They then wanted to go into the room that they had not been into. They offered him money to let them go into the room. He finally consented. Mr. Lawrence opened the door at the foot of the stairs and called and said, Jupiter, for that was my father's first name. You must look out for yourself now, for I cannot hide you any longer. He then told the parson's pickets, they must take care, for Jupiter says he will kill the first man that lays hands on him. They hesitated some. They then went upstairs still and stopped a short time. And then with a rush against the door, it gave way and they all went in. They found the landlady sitting there as composed as summer, with her knitting work, unconscious of an arrest to go south as a slave. But they found us not, although the room they last went into was the one we had occupied all the time we were in that house.
Sometimes the Mars family was forced to hide in the woods.
We saw 14 men on horseback. They were men we knew. The parson was one of them. We hid behind a log that was near us until they got out of sight. We then went into the woods, and there we found my mother and sister. Very soon, the thought of night came to mind. How we were to spend the night, and what we should do for something to eat. But between sundown and dark, a man passed along by the edge of the woods, whistling as he went. After he had passed on, Father went up where the man went along and came back with a pail or basket, and in it was our supper.
After months of stalemate, Reverend Thompson agreed to free most of the family members and to sell James and his brother to a master of their parents' choosing. Under Connecticut's law for the gradual abolition of slavery, they would eventually be freed, but not till the age of 25. James Mars was 8 when he learned he was to be sold.
I was informed that I was sold to Mr. Munger and must go and live with him. The man I did not know, but the thought of being sold, not knowing whether I was ever going to see my parents or brother or sister again, was more than I could endure. It was a sad thought, but I must go. Tears ran down my cheeks. I then felt for the first time that I was alone in the world. No home, no friends, and none to care for me. And now, 65 years have passed away since that time. Those feelings are fresh in my memory.
Fortunately, James's family was able to settle nearby his new owner, and he was allowed to visit them. A barn which belonged to Mr. Munger, his owner, is now part of a Norfolk residence. James was freed in his early 20s, became a landowner in Norfolk, and eventually became a leader of the black community in Hartford. He returned to Norfolk in his later years and became a respected deacon in the Congregational Church, which was built in 1813 and still stands on the Norfolk town green. The graves of James Mars and his father Jupiter Mars, a veteran of the American Revolution, are in Center Cemetery in Norfolk.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is Milo Freeland's grave in North Canaan.
All persons held as slaves within any state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforward, and forever, free.
Abraham Lincoln's 1863 Emancipation Proclamation turned the Civil War into a war against slavery. In its wake, the United States government authorized Massachusetts to organize a regiment of volunteers of African descent. Blacks from around the Berkshires flocked to Pittsfield to enlist in the new 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry. Among the first of them, indeed, one of the first Civil War volunteers in the nation, was Milo J. Freeland, a resident of Sheffield, Massachusetts, now buried in North Canaan, Connecticut. He became one of the first of nearly 200,000 African Americans to serve in the Union Army. Within a few months, 23-year-old Freeland and the rest of the 54th were in combat in South Carolina. On July 18th, the 54th led an attack against Fort Wagner, a heavily fortified Confederate installation guarding the approach to Charleston Harbor. The 54th stormed the fort and suffered severe casualties, earning them the respect of other Union soldiers. Their heroism was portrayed in the motion picture Glory. One survivor recalled,
"The genius of Dante could but faintly portray the horrors of that hell of fire and sulfurous smoke. Language is all too tame to convey the horrors and the meaning of it all."
After the war, Milo Freeland returned to his home in Sheffield, Massachusetts, where he and his wife raised 5 children. During the war, he had acquired an asthma-like breathing disorder, and he died of pneumonia in North Canaan, Connecticut, just across the border from Sheffield at age 43. His gravestone there, with pride, but perhaps with modest exaggeration, declares him,
"The first colored man enlisted from the North in the rebellion of 1861.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Marian Anderson Studio in Danbury.
Contralto Marian Anderson, daughter of a coal and ice dealer and a laundress, grew up in Philadelphia, where she studied singing and sang in the church choir. In 1923, she won a Philadelphia singing contest, and 2 years later won first prize in a competition held by the New York Philharmonic. She debuted at Carnegie Hall in 1929, then toured Europe, creating a sensation wherever she sang. In 1939, the Daughters of the American Revolution refused to allow their Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. be used for a concert featuring Marian Anderson because she was black. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt responded by resigning from the Daughters of the American Revolution and personally organizing an Easter Sunday concert for Anderson at the Lincoln Memorial. Later that year, Anderson was given the Spingarn Award for the highest and noblest achievement by an American Negro. The next year, Marian Anderson and her husband built a home in Danbury where she lived for the following 50 years. Near the house, overlooking a brook and pond, she built a studio, complete with fireplace, recording equipment, and of course, her piano. In 1955, Marian Anderson became the first African-American to sing a featured role at the Metropolitan Opera. She sang at President John F. Kennedy's inauguration in 1961. She was awarded the American Medal of Honor, and on her 75th birthday in 1974, the United States Congress passed a resolution to have a special gold medal minted in her name. Efforts are underway to move her studio and preserve it as a museum.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail is the Hopkins Street Center in Waterbury.
For 150 years, Waterbury was the center of the American brass industry. Thousands of immigrants came from all over the world to work in the brass mills. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a growing number of African Americans began filtering into Waterbury. Many settled in the area around Pearl Street. Waterbury's first black church, now known as the Mount Olive AME Zion Church, was established there in 1879. The Zion Baptist Church was begun nearby in 1921. Half a century after the Civil War, discrimination remained severe in Waterbury, as throughout Connecticut. A study of the Negro population of Waterbury, Connecticut, published by the National Urban League in 1923, noted,
"There are sections in close proximity in which over 90% of the Negro population live. The antagonistic sentiment of whites prevents them from moving outside of the narrow limits of a recognized Negro area."
In the early 1920s, community leaders organized the Pearl Street Neighborhood House, now known as the Hopkins Street Center. It functioned as a community center for more than half a century, providing a location for dances, weddings, and sports activities, classes, summer schools, meeting rooms, and even a bowling alley downstairs. It continues to be used for dances and weddings. Throughout its history, the Pearl Street Neighborhood House was at the center of the struggle for equality by Waterbury African Americans. It was the home of the Waterbury Urban League and the founding location of the Waterbury branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Black women were almost entirely excluded from industrial employment in Waterbury. The 1923 Urban League study found 372 black men, but not a single black woman employed in Waterbury factories. In the early years of World War II, Lila Alexander, head of the Pearl Street Neighborhood House, began a campaign to demand the hiring of black women. She led a coalition which included local black ministers, the Urban League, and the newly emerging CIO industrial unions, which eventually persuaded major local companies to end their ban on hiring black women.
The next site on the Connecticut Freedom Trail are the graves of John C. Norton and Harriet Norton in Plainville.
One of the best documented stations on the Underground Railroad was the home of John Calvin Norton and Harriet Hotchkiss Norton in Plainville. John and Harriet had met when both worked at a local factory, Harriet painting clock dials, John making cabinets. They were passionate abolitionists. Their son, Charles H. Norton, who became an industrial inventor, wrote in his memoirs,
"My parents were abolitionists, and our house was a station on what was known as Red Path's Underground Railroad. Because my parents fed and secreted several colored men on their way to freedom, I was often tormented by the other boys. They chased me home with stones when I ventured out unprotected. On one occasion, in the late evening, a crowd of rowdies came to our house, shouting rough threats with loud calls of, 'Bring out that nigger!' I covered my head under the bedclothes, but my heart beat faster with fear. I shall never forget that almost constant feeling of fear in those days. I remember two colored men whom my parents fed and concealed for a night and a day. They escaped safely, but after the war, one of them returned here and built a home. He became a respected citizen and died here."
Please see the companion booklet for more information about this particular site. The last site on the northwestern section of the Connecticut Freedom Trail is Redeemer's AME Zion Church in Plainville. Please see the companion booklet for information about this particular site.
From Farmington to Danbury, from the 1600s to today, racial prejudice and oppression have been a part of life in northwestern Connecticut. But so has the struggle against them, a struggle conducted by people like Sinquet, John Hooker, Marian Anderson, and Lila Alexander. The sites on the Freedom Trail commemorate a few of the high points of that continuing struggle.
This concludes your tour of the northwestern section of the Connecticut Freedom Trail.